On Friday I was in Dublin, and now I'm here in Cork, so it's fantastic, and thank you very much, Paul, for inviting me to read here. I'm going to do some poems from all of my books, and hopefully you'll join in. First book of poems I carry. It's called Circus. Sometimes I am a circus and you are my fat lady, awash with Melville's legend and the threat of a thousand section encounters with sideshow freaks and red dwarfs that whoop and carouse inside of me when I travel long distances in my car that has no radio. Fat lady, you are my double Adonis, twice wider and deeper than I want to be. You loll outside my trailer, peeling grapes on an upturned orange crate, groaning under your weight, while I secretly thumb through inky personals, looking to replace you with a bearded lady, a tattooed lady. In my room, stark and neat, books alphabetically filed, bedding hidden behind fake wood paneling on which a postcard of Leonardo's cartoon is tacked, perfectly symmetrical to the grooves in the chest sawdust. My billet immaculate as yours is Dionysian. Empty wine bottles strewn, suspended eternal leaves of typewriter paper, concertina solidly in air, heavy with the aroma of fermenting fruit, warmed by candles of sculpted grease and glass. Kitchen knife twangs in the wall next to a disheveled bed, heavily indented with your form. I heave when I am there, smothered by chaos and the bacchanal stickiness of your breast. Sandal feet crunch sawdust, liberating cedar oil scents confined to ankle height by the atmosphere of the room. My spine aches from the pressure of you. One day I will buy a car radio, flee the circus, live a normal life, devoid of you, interloper of my interior monologue. But for now, I am a circus. The newspaper hidden, crushed beside you on the crate, fleshy arm about my shoulder, Siamese-ing me into you. I feel the rasping, sweet liquid roll of the peeled grape across my reluctant tongue. I was in Jamaica a few years ago when a friend of mine asked me to be his best person. So this is the kind of this poem's about the kind of trauma of that. It's called Wedding Rehearsal. I'm standing here, and I'm standing here, and I'm standing here, and I'm standing here, and I'm standing inside a round shuttered church that looks like a trench town shack from the outside. I'm on the inside, I'm on the inside. I'm standing here, and I'm standing here, and I'm standing next to him like I'm the best man bearing witness. Can I get a witness? Can I get a witness? And I'm standing here, and I'm standing here, and I'm standing with his parents, his tense parents. And nothing I say is funny. And I'm standing with his tense parents. This wedding means everything to them, means everything to them, means everything to his tense parents. And I'm standing here with his tense parents. This wedding means everything to them. The jewel of existence, paragon of parental power. I'm standing here, and I'm standing here, and I'm standing next to him like I'm the best man bearing witness, with his tense parents bearing witness. And it's no joke. It's practice, it's practice, it's practice, it's practice. It's just practice for crying at the church on the day. It's just practice for life. I've lived all over the place. I'm a bit of a gypsy, I guess. And one of the places I lived was New Mexico, Taos, New Mexico. And I was hanging out with a guy. If anybody knows jazz here, they might recognize the name Frank Morgan, who was a great jazz saxophonist. And also a big-time junkie, and spent most of his life in prison, which is a kind of a shame because he was so fantastic. But anyway, he was on methadone and practicing again and actually playing in the local pub. We made friends with each other, and so I decided to write this poem for Frank Morgan. It's called Lessons from Frank. When Frank says, but something of you in the place. He plunged me into a rest of the day funk, like I could never be that jazz loosened, loose-boned thing he is, the improv that jazz is all about. A conversation that moves across the stage, lightning moments between the instruments as the response is rethought, the voice that jazz speaks, tell me in that voice. When Frank plays his horn, it's like yesterday it never happened, or tomorrow doesn't need thinking about. The music is just there, his breath following the voice, his fingers squeezing the notes. Melody he sees on his darkened retina, like nothing written and everything felt. When Frank says, always leave room to do what's in your heart, I feel squeezed like an exhalation of breath, like I cannot do what he does, even with my words. When Frank plays live, I'm hearing a breathy intake of air beneath music, the tack of saliva between tongue and reed, a cushioned tap of brass keys, his life's history in the metallic edge of methadone. I'm hearing a life lived, a man learning. I'm hearing Bird and Miles and Lewis in countless hotel rooms and back alleys, the weed urine aroma. When Frank says, I'm no good at taking care of myself, I remember Thelonious with his wife packing a cardboard suitcase and Frank's toffee skin, the reed-leaning bottom teeth. I know it's too late for me to live that life. When Frank's music envelops me in 7 a.m. rising light, the chemise blooming in my breathing, I'm driving up through mountains along the high road past Chimayo, carried away with the salty extravagance of sound, the smooth quality of knowing one's heart, remembrance of love lost and regained, a floating cushion of familiarity. And Frank's notes breathing across a landscape serene, the modulated security of distance. When Frank says, all I want to do is rehearse my craft, I understand the need for selfishness, the quality of genius. From my third book. It's a book called Dark Star Requiem, and it's the libretto basically for an oratorio I did about the history of AIDS in North America and Africa. And these are the poems that became compositions that were sung by a 20 voice choir and 4 opera singers and a whole bunch of musicians. And so it goes something like this. 0 0 0 0 6 1 1 0 6 0 1 0 0 0 0 6 1 1 0 6 0 1 0 0 0 0 6 1 1 0 6 0 1 0 0 0 0 6 1 1 0 6 0 1 0 0 0 0 0 6 1 1 0 6 0 0 9 0 0 0 6 1 1 0 6 0 1 0 0 0 6 1 1 0 6 0 1 0 0 0 6 1 1 0 6 0 1 0 0 0 6 1 1 0 6 0 1 0 0 0 6 1 1 0 6 0 1 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 0 nurse. I feel the brushed warmth of a lover's arms soothe the agonizing want of aching. It is wet, too, in this darkness. Slipperiness of flesh, the idea of beauty, a warm hand takes my arm, guides me through the darkness. Eruptions of light begin as small peripheral flashes, a whisper close to my ear. Pheromonal attraction, the sweet smell, beauty of the whole you. Sticky wickedness as we stumble forward, holding ourselves as a pair. No one else should have you. Needlessly, aimlessly, we move through darkened rooms, glowing like indigent leaves, touch everything we desire. We are drawn by the physicality of sound, pounding in the core of us, stealing our breath. My teeth rattle, I feel your skin vibrate, sweat pours, my hand squeezes your skin, dull rush of wind in my ears. We are buffeted by the bodies of others. Shout, we shout out lustily to God, insulting, cajoling, lamenting, as fetid spit speckles our bodies. In this intimate infernal storm, a roaring in the blood, a single spike, the vortex spins screaming. Beauty mark. Beautiful, I am harbored in your body. Meld myself with your connective tissue. Blush at each move and stretch, the unseen brand of your lovemaking. I move downwards into your body. Mark your wet membranes with the badge of my progression. I proliferate noiselessly, my cancerous bruises, florid and unseen. When I break for air, surfacing on your ankle, I give you my flower, ma fleur de mal. First, a rose blush flattened on the skin, then quickly, as I proffer my beauty, a raised eruption, purple as royalty. Sometimes my beauty mark bleeds blood jewels, sacrament of my adoration, lacrimosa, lacrimosa, lacrimosa. By the time you notice me, I am already languishing in the warm moisture of your lungs and gut, ridging the roof of your mouth with burgundy bubbles. I mark you for others' judgment. Look at us, we are beautiful. Most of my poems are pretty depressing. But hey, that's what poetry is all about. Okay. This is somebody was actually talking about sonograms just now at our table. And this is a poem I wrote for a friend of mine who is also a poet. And we were on tour together in the Pacific Northwest. And she was pregnant. And this poem is about the whole phenomena of the idea that the thief can hear you through the walls, and you know what happens when they actually recognize who you are when they see you. And this is called On Seeing Saphir. When I speak, she recognizes my voice, calculating memories in sapphire clearness, empty abacus screen, the beads waiting for patterns. Where ideas are stored and history formed, past lives and alien interpretations. Through mere centimetres she heard me speak, floated silent as I whispered through sleep, a seashell's shush and the beating of two hearts. Felt my palm, the warm substance of healing, and heard me speak, the hum dull and sometimes ragged, from rooms and corners of rooms, the flat softness of mattress, through the various ambience of streets, car interiors and Greyhound bus stations, words from a poem filtered through auras over clinking silverware in crowded Indian restaurants, sounds floating on amniotic fluid, a vast ocean of language, language. And she heard my voice through telephone cables, over thousands of kilometres on different continents. She heard it accompanied by the somnolent hiss of rain. Before she had ears, she reverberated with my timbre, for perception. Now she hears me speak, clear and without mediation, looks my way, the slow turn of recognition, and it is there. In the deep written pockets of a tabula rasa memory, when I speak, she recognizes my voice. So, my third book of poems, second book of poems, which is this one, Ashes Are Bone and Dust. It's really a kind of a grief book for my parents who died within 10 weeks of each other, some time ago. And so this book is really a kind of sorting out of all the stuff that happens around death and grief. One of the things that my parents wanted to do actually was to die at the same time, which they almost got their wish. But they, you know, very morbid people, and they had their, what they wanted done with their bodies all planned out. And one of the things they wanted was both to be cremated and then scattered over the hill that they did their courting. And so this poem, called, which is the title poem of the book, Ashes Are Bone and Dust, is about when we actually scattered their ashes. When the bone fragments arc to earth, the wind picks up the dust from the ashes before they settle on the ground, separating them on the wing, and blows the dust out of the summit of the hill across the countryside. It is then the magic happens. As the wind has along its body particles of the dust, a cloud that forms and reforms, moving out over the land in a mobile body, as if the two spirits are truly joining, contemplating each other for a moment, rolling and swirling and forming in a comfortable courtship of familiarity. Moving more slowly than the wind, a heavy mass suspended but travelling out over the leaden quality of the stillness of Wilshire. I fully expect their two figures to become visible and smile down on me before melting on the cradle of the wind. Thank you. Okay. As Paul mentioned, I worked with a composer called Andrew Stanland, and we worked on this project called Lingua Elastic. And the idea was that Andrew created a computer musical instrument that sequenced my voice. And we did this performance of recorded material for sequencing and also live interpretations of the poems and the music. And the theme of the poems was how technology impacts humanity in a good way and a bad way. And this is one of the poems from that suite of poems. It's called Telegraph Pole. And I wrote this poem at Squaw Valley, which is a writer's workshop. It's kind of like a boot camp. You have to produce a poem every day and then read it to the group. So this is a telegraph pole. Along the high desert highway, the telegraph pole smooths into blue, altitudinally high sky. Worn, weather-bleached wood splintering like rain shards along its length. Standing straight under the repeating sun, clouds flicker relief, another day, another frittering. Electric signals run through the wires, the muttering garbled and intent, a thousand voices, dots and lines, swimming fish of sine waves, hot blast insulated baubles, glow blue green, birth, death, marriage, defeat, joy, victory, the Dow Jones. Plethora of the essence of what is human. Pine, spine, sentinel, like its stoic brothers, bald tree forced into service. Smile, though your heart is broken. Flat metal number 58, tin tap click against one's trunk, the only sound in the burning noon sweep, save the silent stories running like blood through the wires. Okay, this is going to be my last poem. So I'm not going to leave you like totally depressed. So this is my funny poem. It's only actually one, but anyway. So I assume that everybody knows who Martha Stewart is. You'll kind of get the gist of it. So I'll do the preamble, and the preamble is this. I was in New York at a friend of mine's apartment. She's a poet, she's very cool, and on the table is this copy of Martha Stewart Living, which is a magazine for would-be Martha Stewarts, basically. And the magazine is all how to decorate your house and bake cakes and do handy tips for the kitchen and all this kind of stuff. And it's not really the sort of thing you'd expect to see on a groovy poet's coffee table. But she had it, and I thought, well, how terrible is that? And I picked it up, and I started reading it, and all of a sudden I was hooked, and I was like totally enthralled by this whole magazine. I don't know why, but obviously I'm a closet
masseur or something. Anyway, I didn't think any more of it, and I went home, and a couple of weeks later I got a copy of Martha Stewart Living in the mail, and my friend had given me a subscription to the magazine. And so, of course, and it's my guilty pleasure. Everybody has a guilty pleasure, you know, reading Hello on the on the subway or whatever. But anyway, this is Martha Stewart Living is my guilty pleasure. So you can imagine how distraught I was when I heard that Martha Stewart was going to be jailed for she did that thing where you buy stocks and bought them.
Insider trading.
Oh God, I must write a poem for Martha Stewart, and it's called "Why You Should Be Jailed, Martha." Not because you got greedy and embezzled money, not because I am jealous of your business acumen or that you never seem to age, but because you make me dissatisfied with my life. Every month, when my Martha Stewart Living arrives in the mailbox, I compare my life to chocolate box fantasies. Thumb the pages past Santa Fe cookout brunches, tips on how to wash your pet dog, hang the perfect family portrait, or give a simple but knockout party on your Catskills dog. Every month, my heart wrenches its beat into longing. I want a whitewashed plank dock with wicker chairs to bask in at sunset. I want to be able to wash my dog with an expensive natural sponge and then just throw it away. I want a family to cook for. A family, damn it. Why didn't I think of sewing cheap pillow ticking into myriad coloured dyed napkins with fringes? Why is my evening meal an evening meal rather than a cornucopia of colours, textures and the right balance of food groups served in a white porcelain bowl? Martha, you make me need things I never imagined I wanted. A scrubbed pine, French Baroque-inspired kitchen table with just the right hint of spearmint green white paint glaze. Magic floating candles made from muffin tin moulds. 6 ways to prepare bruschetta, including fava bean with arugula pesto. And apple-cheeked blonde children and a husband to cook for. I never imagined I needed a husband. Martha, my paycheck won't support a second home in Kentucky bluegrass country. My friends barely visit me in Ontario, let alone spend weeks lounging on an ivy-covered porch watching me collect jelly glasses, or invent new ways to serve appetizers made from Kalamata olives and mayonnaise. Martha, I blame you for my newly acquired overspending habit. To prepare a simple grilled chicken and fattoush salad, I need to buy $1,000 Weber barbecue, new plates from Williams Sonoma, and balsamic vinegar that costs more than any good bottle of wine I'll ever drink. Martha, I do not have hours to spend sniffing for the perfect cantaloupe in farmers' markets, piercing corn kernels with my fingernail to see if they leak white fluid to prove they're ripe. My days are not spent of ways to display color-coordinated wildflowers in large seashells, or wondering how the American flag should be displayed and if it should come in at night. I would need a husband to manage that, and I don't have one. And I don't have a large, extended, perfectly behaved, photogenic toothsome family with shiny hair to sit around on my overstuffed chintz covered by me sofa, or children running around the house giggling with their renovated antique toys found at flea markets. And Martha, while I don't blame you for your lapse in judgment when you thought you didn't have as many millions as a self-made businesswoman should, I do blame you for my discontent. And you should be jailed for publishing that magazine, that full colour, glossy, pornographic catalogue of consumerism you call Martha Stewart Living. And I blame you, Martha, that I can't tear myself away from it each and every month. Thank you.